Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities are facing challenges like declining student enrollment and less money from the state over the past decade. Higher education overall is changing, and the state schools often haven't kept pace in some ways. The Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education has a new chancellor, and he appears to be willing to aggressively redesign the PASHE institutions. Dr. Daniel Greenstein, the chancellor of the PASHE system, is with us today. Dr. Greenstein, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here on this snowy morning.
It is a snowy morning. I want to play something from your inaugural address earlier this week.
I'm not talking about modest adjustments to our enterprise. We will not tweak our way out of this. The challenges we face are too great, the stakes are too high. What I'm talking about is fundamental transformation and redesign.
And as I said, aggressively attacking change for the state system of higher education. We'll talk about those changes, but I also want to address the challenges right up front. By the way, I want to let our listeners know, if you have a question or comment, we know there are a lot of graduates out there, and maybe even students of the state system of higher education. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. If you have a question or a comment, you also can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, here's the broadest question of all. What's your vision for the state system of higher education?
No, that's great. Thanks very much. And let me just add an invitation to our thousands of fabulous faculty and staff, if I may welcome
them. And I know they're listening, too.
They may be listening, to phone in with questions. So the vision for the system is actually quite simple. It's a system of universities that the people of the state can be enormously proud of, that continue their historic service to their communities and to the state, that are agile in response to changing needs, both of students and employers, and of their communities, and that are sustainable, not just in terms of their longevity, but in terms of their ability to maintain affordable, high-quality education as they have in the past, and they will continue to do in the future.
You're from Seattle. What attracted you? What made you want this job?
Well, it probably wasn't the weather, he says, on a morning.
Come on.
No, it is fabulous. I grew up in this part of the world, and it's fabulous to be home. So, I have spent years in higher education, and to be perfectly honest, the challenges that are confronting our wonderful universities are challenges that are general across public higher education in particular. And they are serious. And addressing them is essential to the economic and social and political well-being of our nation. And so as I stepped down from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I was looking for a public institution which was facing those challenges acutely and which I believed was positioned to address them aggressively and successfully, not only in the interest of the people in the region, in this case the state, but in the interest of identifying new models for public higher education in the 21st century, it is about reimagining public education for the 21st century.
And we're going to talk about reimagining in just a moment. One of the things that, and I want to talk about higher education overall before we narrow it down, the conversation down to the 14 state-owned schools. What hasn't happened in higher education? What are the challenges facing higher education that may or may not be specific to the 14 state-owned universities here in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think the generalized challenges run as follows, and there are several. The one that I always return to is that if you look at our enrollments, student enrollments, really for the last 50 years, they've been growing steadily, accelerating into the 80s, 90s, and in the early 1000s. And so, one of the unsung victories of public policy in the 20th century, frankly, has been the ability of our public universities to open their doors to hundreds of thousands, millions of students to grow. And not just open their doors and grow in terms of enrollment, but to change the complexion of the student body that becomes much more like the face of America in terms of its diversity with respect to income and race, ethnicity, et cetera. So growing rapidly and accommodating students from very different backgrounds and successfully turning those students into graduates in the 20th century has been an enormous victory of education public policy, I believe. The challenge, of course, now is that the high school leaving population, the size of the high school leaving population, which has been the large part of the traditional population, is flat, and our enrollments have been declining. And so one of the biggest challenges we face is that we're all trained in growth, and now we're dealing with contraction. I think the other thing is that the other broad brush structural thing is that workforce needs have changed. So in the 2025, the data suggests that in the state of Pennsylvania, 54% of the adult population is going to require some form of education after high school. In order really to sort of to fuel the economic strength and development of the state. The good news is the state already is at about 53%. The bad news is that the skills that graduates are graduating with aren't aligned to the skills that the employers require who are looking for people with some form of post-secondary education. So we're looking at figuring out how to contract. We're looking at how to evolve our education so that it meets the needs of a very rapidly changing economy. And of course, we're doing this in a time when there is vicious competition, in a good way, I guess, for public dollars. So there are lagging public investments, and you see that sort of drives tuition increases, which make it much more difficult to go to college, much less affordable, which is having an impact on our enrollments, which are difficult anyway if the high school leaving population is contracting. So you've got all these things happening, and they're happening all over the country. So we're really looking fundamentally for whole different business and educational models that enable us to continue our great universities into the future so that they maintain their historic role in our communities.
What you just described is, you know, those are a few of the problems that the state system has experienced here in Pennsylvania. Let's talk about a couple of them. Student enrollment. I saw a figure that the state system had 120,000 students.
Yeah.
Just a few years ago,
yeah.
Maybe 10 years ago, now you're down to 98,000 students.
Yeah.
Some of the individual institutions have really been hit hard.
Yeah.
Cheney, for example,
yeah.
had 1,568 students in 2010. Now they have 469.
Yeah.
It's hard to run a university with 469 students. That's just one example. Only Westchester and Millersville had increased enrollment. You kind of named, you listed some of the reasons, but that's a real challenge if you don't have as many high school students coming out.
Yep.
And maybe some of the fewer that are coming out can't afford it. All right. So how do you deal with that issue?
So there's no, and these are the challenges of higher education. So, you know, and again, back to the earlier point, I think the Pennsylvania state system is uniquely positioned to address them more aggressively, more effectively than other institutions, which is why I came here. So there's a number of things. So number one, on average, 53% of the students who start as freshmen in our universities will go on to graduation, which means
is that overall? Is that nationally?
That's over. We're a bit above the national average in our category,
mm-hmm.
like a point or two. But that's overall in Pennsylvania state system, 53% thereabouts. It could be a little bit off, but not by much. And which means 47% don't. Now, of those 47%, a whole bunch go to other schools. They go out and they get great jobs. So that's, you know, let's count those as successes, and we've launched them on their careers. They're very difficult. And we can find them in the data. I mean, not at the individual level, but at the aggregate. But there's a bunch who are just stopping out. So one way to increase enrollments is do better with those who are stopping out. So the question is, okay, why are they stopping out? What can we do to help them stay, right? So that so retention. And there's all sorts of good things going on in our universities to improve retention. We're seeing some really positive signs of development. So retention's a big deal. Obviously, there's adult population. I don't have the numbers for Pennsylvania. Nationally, they estimate 37, or we estimate 37. There's 37 million adults with some college and no degree. So looking into that population and doing programs which reach out directly to adults to get them to degree completion, working directly with employers and employer associations for reskilling and upskilling. So again, in the adult marketplace, looking for a whole new variety of students who are going to require coming back into higher education, actually other forms of education as well, in order to continue to develop their careers. So how can we position ourselves in that market as well? So there's a handful of things that one can do, and obviously, and continue obviously to focus on the high school leaving population, and to be clear about the value that the Pennsylvania state system universities bring to that, to those students, which is enormous value when you consider our overall price and its compares and how it compares to other options in the state.
What is your overall price now?
Oh gosh, it's overall, if you include tuition, room, board, and fees, and it's a different. There are variations between the universities, but we're looking at about, I don't know, $23,000-$24,000 a year.
Now that's for in-state students, right?
For an in-state student, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to retention for just a moment. You said that there are some of the institutions that are really doing some good things, some innovative things to retain students. Like, yep. What?
Oh gosh,
what works?
Yeah, what works? So the things that and this again, so Pennsylvania state system is a microcosm of the broader ecosystem in higher ed. There's some the things that I've been impressed with at our universities and nationally. Advising, student advising is super important. Ensuring that students actually understand why they're doing the program of study they're doing and where that program of study leads and what that program of study entails and what it costs and what happens if you deviate from it and you want to take a course over here, which is fine, of course, but how does that affect your path? So all those kinds of issues, advising about money, financial aid, loans, work, different ways students can fund their education, that the combination of fund sources that a student puts together will actually have some impact on their likelihood of succeeding. So can they be advised effectively in understanding that? What does it mean to take loans? What does that entail after I graduate? What does it mean to pay back loans? So providing a lot of support and advice. And there's really good evidence nationally about advising interventions, I'll call them, or solutions, and that work, a holistic approach, a whole student approach, a sort of a concierge model is very, very powerful. And we're seeing that trial in a number of our institutions with some really interesting results. The other thing which I've seen, which I've been very impressed by, and again, a number, and I'll do two more, a number of our campuses are doing it. It's called the first year experience, right? The first, that transition, I'm not talking about a high school student, but it's true with an adult who's returning to university after maybe several years away, or for someone transitioning to university from a community college, that first year, that first semester is absolutely critical. Because it's in that semester that you're going to gain the skills, and it's not just the cognitive academic skills. It's the how do I navigate this environment, which is going to be different than you experienced in high school or that you experienced in your community college or that you experienced at in your workplace. How do I navigate that successfully, and how do I work some of those navigational aids into the curriculum so that students are going to confront that navigational support in the way the curriculum is designed. And we've seen some really exciting stuff happening at a handful of our institutions. The last one I'll go to is that academic, what happens in the classroom, and I'm putting my fingers up in inverted commas because classrooms these days are not often, you know, the traditional in the room kind of thing with seats and desks and stuff. But what happens in the classroom is only a part of the whole student experience, right? What happens in the dorm or what happens in student clubs or what happens in sports, super important. And internships and apprenticeships and externships, in-service learning opportunities. And so there's some interesting work that's going on, again, at a handful of our universities to build curricula of non-academic things that students can do and to transcript those things that a student has done. So when they go to their employer, when they go through life, they can say, here, I majored in poli-sci with a double minor in Spanish and economics. I just made that up, and those were not my areas of study. And I also did the following things, showing a real progression in my leadership development skills. Or, you know, I made that up too. But those are transcriptable activities, transcriptable skills that I can now present to an employer or the next phase of my life. And that's super important. It's helping students prepare for the world beyond. That's been incredibly, incredibly successful as well. We have some great work there going on.
I want to get back to that in a moment, but one quick question. You said about, we were talking about tuition and cost for an in-state student. It would seem that there's only a finite number of students graduating high school in Pennsylvania, that to increase enrollment, one way to do it would be to attract students from out of state. Why would out of state students come to a Pennsylvania university?
No. Well, I think I would take that generally, not just out-of-state students, but, you know, any student. I mean, and I've been to all the 14 universities.
I want to talk about that, too.
Yeah, well, we'll get there. I'll get there.
Do you have, like, T-shirts printed up with the PASHI tour?
That's right.
The PASHI. 2018.
It will not be my... It's only my first tour. I'm looking forward to going back in the spring, if they'll have me. You know, these are profoundly interesting places. I mean, I'm saying this is a guy who's been in education probably too long. But, you know, I've been on a lot of campuses. I love that. I love university visits. It's where the life of education takes place, right? And our universities have some pretty unique qualities. You know, I mean, they offer the kind of experience I would describe it as a liberal arts the kind of experience you'd expect at a liberal arts college, where you have a very high degree of student interaction with faculty. And it comes out in every conversation you have with students and in every conversation you have with faculty. But it's the students I'm listening to in particular on that score, right? And the value that brings, it's incredible. And, of course, the price point is very, very different. So the second thing that I became aware of is that our universities are actually quite different. And it sort of flies in the face of a narrative which suggests somehow we're all the same. And we're not all the same. We're very different in ways which reflect the communities that we serve. Our academic programming is very different. The feel and look and the student life of a place is very different. And so they have unique characteristics, our universities, which are worth digging into. And then the third thing is that, you know, they are actually very much conscious of and aligned with the needs of a student, not just going out and getting the first job. Obviously, that's important, but having a career. You know, so these are places which are steeped in the liberal arts, and they're developing increasingly career-aligned kinds of programming, whether it's in healthcare, business, or STEM, STEM fields, and engineering, computer science, et cetera. And so you have that combination of being able to provide our students with a good grounding in the critical thinking and communication skills, the group learning type activities, the kind of stuff you typically associate with the liberal arts education, and layering on top of that the skills that are critical to work in a particular career area. And that combination, you don't find that everywhere. I won't say it's unique, but it is very distinctive and it is very strong. And, you know, the narrative around the Pennsylvania state system doesn't really often go in that direction. And, you know, I encourage those who have a different view to come with me on my next set of campus visits. They have to bring their bikes because we start every visit with a ride in the morning. But it's worth doing.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Daniel Greenstein, the Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Brand new to the job. He's been here since September, but was just inaugurated earlier this week. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get to phone calls and emails, because we do have a few, wanted to talk about one of the challenges that I think a lot of institutions face, but it is especially an issue here in Pennsylvania, not just with the state-owned universities, but even with the state-associated universities like Penn State, Temple, and Pitt. And that is, there has been a cut, more than one, in state funding. About a decade ago, I remember Governor Tom Corbett, former governor, first year in office, cut funding to the state system almost in half. Yeah. Now, I think since then that the funding has increased, but it's probably up to the level, maybe a little bit more, I don't know for sure, than what it was 8 years ago. All right, everyone's looking for money. You said it earlier about we know dollars are tight, public dollars are tight. So what has this lack of funding, this cut in funding, this leveling off at this point of funding done? What has it resulted in with the state system of higher education?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. First of all, pressure on public funding again is a national trend, you know, Pennsylvania is particularly challenged in that way. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think, obviously, we're very grateful for the increases in public funding that we've received over the past several years. They've helped enormously. A number of things happen when public funding is cut. Or is not at a level which is necessary to sustain the educational system as it was. Obviously, cuts are taken in a variety of ways. Number of academic programs, the availability of support for students, deferring maintenance on buildings, et cetera. So I have to say our universities have been, I'm very impressed with the what I would call recession management techniques that they've used to sort of mitigate the impacts of the cuts. They are noticeable, increasingly noticeable, but they are managed really well. It forces universities to think very differently about how they operate. Are they operating most effectively? Are they making difficult trade-off decisions so that they're channeling the resources that they do have into the things which are they consider to be most important? And that, of course, is a very localized decision. I think the other impact, obviously, is it forces universities to put more pressure on their students. And so the biggest sort of economic trend line that I'm aware of in higher education, and again, it's a national phenomenon. The state higher education elected officials, their organization publishes data on this annually. And what you see is a decline of public funding over a period of time from, 60 or 70% of the total revenues that are available to a university, with tuition making up a large part of the remainder. And now those numbers are flipped. And so that the burden of the largest share of the cost of higher education falls directly on the student. 75%, I think, is the average in our system. So that you're pushing the responsibility for funding onto the individual. And there's a lot of conversation about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. There's a strong element of higher education, which is a public good. The impacts on the state of that mismatch between skills that are available and the skills that the economy needs, that's a profoundly challenging position for a state to be in. It's very difficult to think about today and to legislate and act for today because the impacts are probably 10 and 15 years out. But one can project what those impacts will be, right? And it's very interesting, to be in a state. We're surrounded by other states, all of which compete with each other for investment, for industry development, for economic activity, in effect. There's a solid line that you can draw between the extent to which a population is educated and available, and the willingness of commercial entities to invest in that state. So there's a premium on having an educated citizenry, and it's a premium that is worth paying because it has benefits that go to everybody in the state. Those are big public policy issues that are beyond my pay grade, but they're policy issues that states are grappling with. And there is a disadvantage for a state to be too much behind in that conversation, especially when the surrounding states are actively engaged with it. So I think you've got micro impacts on the university, and then of course on the student, which is the most distressing in so many ways. But then there's these macro impacts, which I think that's where you really begin to engage in this conversation about education as a public good.
Governor Corbett, 8 years ago, when he directed those cuts, said that the money was not being spent efficiently. So basically what he was doing was forcing the universities, the institutions, to spend more wisely. We have a phone call along those lines. John is in Harrisburg. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't see a lot of what's going on in the state higher education system as far as spending the taxpayers' money wisely. Look at what's going on with Lincoln with the extremely low enrollment. How can the state subsidize, which is what it's doing, millions of dollars for that low student population? Plus, even on top of that, the existing university, so say like that's increased enrollment with Millersville University. I'm a graduate of Millersville myself. I graduated back in 2000. When I started there, they had three brand new dorms built just 20 years ago. Those dorms have all been ripped down. So how can you justify building multi-million dollar dorms that you ripped down less than 20 years later?
Mm-hmm.
The cost per housing, it's ridiculous.
Thank you very much for your call. Let me just add to that, in that one of the things that you notice when you go to a college campus is that there seems to be a lot of building going on. I know part of that, and you can disagree with me, but I would think that part of that is that institutions are competing for students. Students want the newest, the best. the most cutting edge. So there's almost like an arms race amongst institutions. But where is that line drawn between, as you said, right now the focus is on, when it comes to money, on the in cost, on the student. Where is that line drawn between building, expanding, being the newest, being the best, and providing the best education?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. So the first, I wanted to get to the first part of the question, you know, how we're spending the money and, you know, what's the visibility into it. And that's a great question. And I wanted to make the point in response to the last question about, you know, the role of the state and public funding. This is a partnership. Public education is a partnership. It's a partnership between the state and the people. And the universities, or in this case, the system and the universities. And in that partnership, there are roles and responsibilities for all the partners. And the responsibility, in my view, for the universities and the system is to be transparent about how that money is being spent and to be accountable for how that money is being spent, which to me means being able to say, you know, with clarity and conviction, this is what we're doing. These are the goals we're pursuing. These are the outcomes we're expecting, and this is what it costs. That's the forward look. And then to begin, and then the backward look is, this is how we've done, and this is where the money's gone, and this is the progress we've made against those goals.
Okay, let me interrupt for just a second. You said accountability.
Yep.
Accountable to who, and who decides?
Accountable in terms of accountability, accountable to the people of Pennsylvania.
How does accountable to people of Pennsylvania? How do you measure that?
Well, it's multiple layers of accountability. So you're accountable to the state, which pays 25% of our total revenue, right? Accountable to students. Students pick up 75% of the bill, so they're paying whatever. I may have overstated the total cost, 22, whatever, 3,000, 22 or 23,000. You know, we're accountable to them for, you know, what are we doing with your money? There's accountability to the community and the communities that we serve. I think there's a level of accountability. But the same information, in my view, serves all of those communities equally well, right? And that is, again, where are we going? What are we doing with the money? What are our outcomes and objectives? And then being clear about how we've done in the past. And that way, students can make decisions. We talked earlier about students. You know, how do you demonstrate the value of an institution to a student? Students can make decisions on the basis of information they have about the university they're going to, what it costs, what the outcomes are likely to be. State can make better informed decisions about funding. Employers, frankly, can make better decisions about recruiting. Teacher development. Wouldn't it be interesting if school districts were recruiting teachers on the basis of the quality of the students who are graduating from that school and they're coming, you know, out and they're being teachers? Wouldn't it be interesting if employers began to recruit from universities that are producing great graduates and that are demonstrably producing great graduates? And that's beginning to happen in a handful of areas. So there's multiple layers of accountability, but they can be well served by a small set of, in my view, a small set of measures, which increasingly you're beginning to see them used in a standard way across higher education. So I think accountability is important. And I can tell you for a fact that amongst my my colleagues, presidents and leadership teams, there is a real interest in me. There is a great interest in accountability. There's no objection to it or fear of it. It's something that we believe in, and I think it's something that we're actually pretty good at in terms of the level of information that we're providing about what we do.
But getting back to John's question about building, I mean, where is that line, though?
Yeah. So
I mean, and first of all, is that accurate to say that an accurate observation that schools are in competition with one another, even amongst the 14 state-owned universities, competing for students, and students today are looking for new dorms, maybe paying for not having a roommate, good food plans, good sports programs, all those things. Again, they want to have a life beyond just the classroom. So how do you balance, how do the schools balance those things?
So I think that's exactly right. It's a competitive market, and as the traditional part of that market, the high school leaving population, is contracting, it becomes even more competitive. And this is a state which is, you know, it's pretty crowded with higher education institutions. So it's intensely competitive in Pennsylvania. And so what you're seeing is a reaction to that. So you're absolutely right. It is very difficult, and this is why change is so hard, transformational change in particular, because, all right, we know what that looks like. We know, and we've been doing it for years, and doing it pretty well, actually. We know how to compete for students in a very, you know, traditional way, right? The sustainability of that model is really what we're talking about, and you know, we all can sit back and look at the long term and say, wow, it's hard to see how we're going to be able to continue that, you know, for 10 and 15 and 20 years. But then what is the change? What do we change to? What does that look like? So that's visioning that is hard. And then having the faith to execute against it. Because it's one thing, and you see this in a lot of other industries where, you know, their product or their service, and I don't want to, you know, I don't believe that higher education is a product, but just to make the analogy, you know, where you see an industry where the principal product is becoming obsolete. Eastman Kodak is a perfect example. Getting out of the film-based camera business was an act of faith that company couldn't take in time. And so that's tough to do. So what does that new model look like? And then how does it present service to the students? And what's the risk of transitioning away from something that we know, even though it's got its challenges, to something that we've never done before, right? And I think that is the struggle across higher education. It is, you know, there's risk in it, but the challenges that we're referring to really require bold action. And you know, you can point to a handful of places which have taken bold action very successfully, and you begin to wonder whether, in fact, victory, if that's the right word, or success, let's put it that way, success goes to the courageous. And maybe not to the meek. And so I think that's where we are in Pennsylvania, thinking about what that looks like.
I'm going
to
take some more phone calls and emails here in a second, but one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is to talk about this redesign, this transformation. Now, you've touched on a number of things here, but you had some specific things in mind in your address earlier this week. One thing in particular that I think is very interesting, that a student who attends a state-owned university, one of the 14 institutions, would have access to a program that's not being offered at their school, but is offered at another PASHE school. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, at least the way I approach the world, and I think I'm really reflecting what our leadership and our faculty are doing at our universities, is, you know, what we're trying to do is to design an experience for today's student. And, of course, today's student is not monolithic. You know, an adult student is very different than a high school leaver, very different from a veteran returning to college, and there's any number of other different kinds of student groups that you might refer to. So it's not a monolithic group of students that we're serving, but what we're trying to do is to design an education which serves those students, understanding those particular student groups. For each of those groups, what's the kind of experience that they need, and how can we support it, right? So everything is designed around the student. So I think that's the first thing. And so that notion about remember, the entire exercise is student design to ensure that our students, whichever groups they come from, that the students that we enroll, that they have the highest possible chance of success. So what does that redesign look like? And in that conversation about cross-campus instruction, or every student on every campus being able to take courses, they said there's a number of different kinds of student needs that might serve. I think of them as use cases. I'm a student at a university, and I'm majoring in, we did economics already, so I'm going to do some aspect of biochemistry. I don't know why.
You want to be a doctor.
I want to go into an allied health profession, but I have a profound interest in Spanish, and Spanish is not available on my university. This is a system of just south of 100,000 students. We've got everything. Why shouldn't that student have access to Spanish? It doesn't, and they don't have to travel for. There's this thing called the internet, apparently, and I'm told it works reasonably well. And anyway, there's just that. Imagine, so there's a particular use case. You know, there's another in which, you know, you're thinking about work. I'm going to stick with healthcare. You're thinking about work in healthcare, where you know, a lot of the healthcare professional development and education that we offer is feeding regional needs. Right, we're populating local hospitals and clinics with nurses, et cetera, physicians, assistants, et cetera. Well, in healthcare, there's a variety of specialties, right, that are required, geriatric, mental health and well-being, et cetera. Imagine the opportunity of pulling all of those specialties together by drawing on the particular skills and capabilities of the faculty across the several of our universities, so that any one university that wants to get into that educational programming area can do it drawing on the full capability that exists across the system. I've spoken at some length with the computer science folks, you know, who really want to do, you know, data science is big. Super big, and it's big in everything. It's big in healthcare. It's big in higher ed. It's big in information science. It's big, you know, any particular industry is, you know, out grabbing up data scientists if they can get them. So it's a huge growth area. Super hard to do. There's a lot of application areas, and data scientists, as happens, are hard to get. Right. So imagine the opportunity of again, you know, a kind of a, this is another use case of being able to draw the collective talent across a variety of computer science departments in order to offer the best. You know, so what we're doing is looking at these, you know, what are these use cases? Let's look at whether or not this cross-campus instruction makes a lot of sense. What's going to cost? What's the opportunity? But look, in this industry scale, I'm going to say it, size, it really matters. It, you know, and it's not about cost. It's about quality. Because at scale, you have access to the best people. And in a way that it's hard to do in smaller units. So the question is, how can we use our scale? The scale, where does it make sense? It's not all everywhere. Where does it make sense? And so this is something that we just met with our presidents and our chief academic officers and our chief financial officers after the board meeting. And this was a very animating conversation. And it's super interesting. I mean, these folks are really charged up and working very hard on thinking about this stuff, which is great. Yeah.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is the new chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, Dr. Daniel Greenstein. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we're at Smart Talk WITF. I want to get to the emails and the phone calls that we have some callers patiently waiting. Someone asked in an email here, there was some talk of some of, and it's used the terminology underperforming, but the colleges, under-enrolled colleges that may need to be closed, is that under consideration?
No, not by me at this time. Look, we've got education. You know, I'm an educator. Taking education away from communities that need it most is a really hard thing to do, and it's not the right thing to do. The question is, how can we actually sustain universities operating well in the regions that they serve so that Pennsylvanians, all Pennsylvanians, can have access to a quality, affordable education?
Okay, but key word there, you said operating well. Some of these may not be operating well.
Well, I'm going to go back to this conversation about leveraging our scale. And leveraging our tremendous talent across the system. And it's not just talent. We talked about instruction. What about, you know, talent in doing all sorts of, you know, back office function? It's not clear to me that every institution, to be a really great educational institution, you know, has to run the full stack of business back end office functions. I don't believe it. I don't see it. And I don't see it being done cost effectively. So are there ways we can actually support all of our universities doing their work as well as they possibly can, again, by drawing on the collective strengths of our system?
So, no, right now, closing or merging something that's been suggested, that's off the table?
Closing universities has incredible impacts in the regions that they are focused on, the regions that they serve. The socioeconomic dislocation is profound. I mean, I would encourage folks who are very interested in that approach to cost it out. And it's not clear. In fact, the data suggests that you know, the students who would be left high and dry in those areas, they don't just pick up necessarily and move. And so, you know, are we really willing to, in effect, disenfranchise from a very reliable pathway into a sustaining career and to contributions to our, you know, community and et cetera? Are we willing to just say that whole region, it's okay? Mm.
Let's take a call from Peter in Harrisburg. Peter, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. Chancellor, I'm glad to hear you on the air, and I hear you as I hear many educators talk about preparing people for life. But I don't hear an emphasis on preparing the whole person for the whole life, learning how to think, how to act, and respond, I hear mostly from educators today, the need to prepare people for careers. And while that's certainly an integral and important part of life, there's so much more to life. There's art, there's music, there are people to entertain us and do other things. They all need to be prepared so the rest of us have a better life. And I'd like to hear more emphasis on that, please. And thank you very much for working in education. My children, my grandchildren, and now my great-grandchild will benefit from that. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much for your call.
No, that's a great question, Peter. We may have missed the probably 10 or 15 minutes into the conversation that we're having. We did talk about, you know, the great strength of our universities. One of the great strengths is that they are just really good at that kind of preparation, that kind of traditional liberal arts education. I think the uniqueness, certainly great distinctiveness about our universities, is that they're able to embed into that kind of education, which is so important for all the reasons that you've just outlined. They're able to embed in that the kind of education which will then also prepare you with the technical skills you may need in order to be effective within a particular career. So we are uniquely positioned to have the best of both worlds, which I agree with you entirely, is super important. The whole student is important to think about, and that's not just a bunch of technical competencies that one can deliver.
John emails us, says Pennsylvania is the second highest state in terms of student loan debt, and yet we have the fewest number of community colleges in the country among states that have any, about one every 700,000 students. This indicates that perhaps the future of higher education needs to be met by building more affordable institutions, not merely trying to make existing institutions more affordable.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're touching on a really good point, which has to do with, again, it's a major education public policy issue. And there are conversations with, you know, very good and very interested and caring legislators who are thinking deeply about, you know, what is the education ecosystem, if I can call it that, look like in the state of Pennsylvania, and how can we allocate funding and create policies that will ensure that that ecosystem serves a multiplicity of needs, because there are a multiplicity of needs. Let's not forget, 54% of the adult population in 2025 is going to require some form of higher education. That means 46% workforce doesn't require that. I think that math is right. They may require some very specific career and technical and vocational kinds of training. Where that's coming from, and how do we comprehend that entire educational ecosystem? So not only does it serve the needs of the state and its employers, but it is managed in a way which is sustainable for the public purse and the students who are picking up such a large share in their tuition. That's a really important set of questions. And the community colleges and their interrelationships with the state relateds and with the state system, with independence, all come into that broader conversation. It's a very important one to have.
Something else he mentioned in his email, John said about the second highest student debt. Huge problem. There's a story out just today that housing is being impacted. There are fewer houses being sold because there are so many young people, especially, who are not able to afford a mortgage because they have such a high student debt. What do we do about that?
Yeah, no student. I mean,
that's an economic, hardcore economic question right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you see in the industry is, in higher education, is you're seeing some interesting experimentation with very different kinds of funding models. And very different kinds of, which would include things like income sharing agreements, where students sign on, instead of taking traditional loans, they sign on to deals where they're paying a portion of their income back over time. And those income sharing arrangements can be adjusted in ways that don't impede people from going into low-wage occupations. For example, social work typically is lower salary than, for example, some aspects of business or computer engineering. You're seeing subscription-based models beginning to emerge so that students can have access to credit-bearing courses over a period of time on the basis of some, like, monthly payment. You're seeing a lot of really interesting work with industry, you know, much-touted relationship between Starbucks and Arizona State University, where Starbucks is actually paying its employees, subsidizing its employees to go to Arizona State University because, actually, they discover that baristas will hang around longer and work at Starbucks longer if for those benefits and if they have that opportunity at education. So there's an economic value to Starbucks and to other companies that are beginning to create these relationships. This is profoundly important. And I would argue that it's going to require the same kind of innovation with respect to state funding, that the traditional models are beginning to break around the edges. And the reason we know they're beginning to break around the edges is for the kind of indicators that you've just mentioned. The burden is falling too heavily on our students.
Do you want to break the system down?
So, say more about that.
Well, I mean, it sounds, when you say that this system, okay, system, I didn't mean the state system specifically. I mean, how you're talking a lot about traditionally how we have done things.
Yeah.
You said very early on, education for the 21st century. We're a fifth of the way through the 21st century.
Yeah.
I mean, are you talking about major, major changes here? I hate to use the word revolution, but yeah. When you talk about redesign, transformation, are you talking, should we go back to square one? Build it all over again?
Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, this is a challenge that we debated in the Gates Foundation where I worked previously. And the question, you know, there we were investors, philanthropists, the family were investors, philanthropists, and we were their agents and administrators, their staff. The questions that we debated was, should we work outside the industry and invest in these whole new forms? Or should we actually invest in evolving and helping and supporting the structures that exist? In my time, the burden of the effort was with the existing structures. Why? Because that's where the students are. And you know, there's a lot of really interesting activity in the surrounding, in the startup kind of space, and it's super important, and it's growing, and it's getting really exciting. And you know, we talk, for example, there are plenty of examples in this state, but you're talking hundreds of students, and social and economic need is millions of students. And where are those millions of students? So I think I'm really talking more about transitioning and transforming what we have than blowing it up and starting again. But there are others who do that.
Blowing up was the word I was looking for. But yeah, that's okay. Carly, is it Lancaster? Carly, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Chancellor, my question has to do with your emphasis on the first year experience. And I'm wondering how many of your institutions, I know some of them, like IUP, for example, relies heavily on temporary and or adjunct faculty members to teach a lot of those first year intro level courses. So I'm wondering how students can have a positive first year experience and feel really connected to their university when many of their faculty members themselves may not be very connected to the institution or the program that they're in.
Yeah, so a couple things. Let me start with the adjunct. So 75%, I'm close again on the numbers, of our faculty are tenured or tenure track, which means only 25% are temporary adjuncts. That is pretty much the reverse, almost the reverse of the national average. Right now, it's different by different sectors. So I think we have done incredibly well. I'm proud of our system for maintaining that balance, thing one. Thing two, our adjuncts, you know, again, nationally, and there's a lot of challenge with adjuncts, so I don't want to minimize them. Our adjuncts are well paid by comparison to the national average, almost double probably the national average per course, if you know. And that's a good thing for the reasons that you're pointing out, because they're responsible for our students. So I guess I would just almost, you know, question whether the fact that one is an adjunct in this system is actually disenfranchising to the extent that's actually showing up in their performance in the classroom. I doubt that.
We only have about a minute and a half left. I'm going to try to get to a couple of things here. And we have something here from an adjunct instructor in a science department for Apache School. I see the real passion of all faculty for our students. Of course, all education conversations are about the people, faculty, administration, support staff, students. Do you think that adding more practical programs, as like carpentry, HVAC, as well as virtual, as part of the higher ed survival for Apache, there's no way to make laboratory skills virtual?
I'm the first to agree with you that there are not every discipline or subject area is congenial to online education. Absolutely correct.
Yeah. We only have about 45 seconds left, and Chancellor, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I hope we can have you on again in the future as you're here a little bit longer and get to do that second tour of the universities. In the 30 seconds or so we have left, message you'd like to leave with the people of Pennsylvania, students of Pennsylvania, educators of Pennsylvania.
Oh, no, that's fabulous. This is really a profound honor to be able to serve in this system. It is a fabulous place. every single one of its universities is a fabulous place. I have met more energized and creative and talented and passionate people in 4 or 5 months than I knew existed on the face of the earth, and I am honored and humbled to work amongst them. If you're looking at a university, you should be looking at one of ours. I mean, as a student, it is a remarkable place to be.
The new chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, Dr. Daniel Greenstein. Dr. Greenstein, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday's program, it is Martin Luther King Day. We're going to talk about race relations, discrimination, a lot of other things coming up on Monday's program. So be sure to tune in.